Blog Talk Radio.
Because we're married to stay alive in this most existential of moments. You're now tuned into Blog Talk Radio. We humbly serve with a higher inner frequency. We call ourselves Soul Class. This is Soul Class 731, Anusim on the Rise, Part 27. Baruch Hashem. Blessed is our eternal creator. Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the entire human family experience. With creator's help, our next program is taking place right now on August 25th, 2019, starting at 6 p.m. Holy Land Time of Israel. Well, it's actually 6.02 p.m. there, corresponding to 11.02 a.m. time, live from Turtle Island, equals AKA, equals USA, equals Unified Soul Actualization. Program content will focus on being in discussion with Ezra Nusim, Israeli Amuta CEO, Yafi Bati Dekasi, will share with us what are the latest developments regarding this growing human soul movement. In addition, she plans to introduce a new member of her team, manager and director for social media, Ariana Sadikoff. We'll also share her journey back to Judaism. And you can further interact with Yafa Bati DaCosta by going to her email at yaffbatya@yahoo.com. To participate or to merely listen to the program, you can call in 347-838-8669, and of course your humble local international cyberspace Torah librarian, Torah Askan, Manusa Goodman, is here at the control board, trying to stay a little bit in control with all this modern technology. Good morning, Yafia Batya, and good morning, or good afternoon, good evening, early good evening, Yafia Batya, and good morning, Ariana.
Yes, hi, Dawn, how you doing?
Baruch Hashem, as they say, the heart is pumping, the feet are jumping, and we have no time for slumping.
We have a really, really fabulous show for people today because Ariana is with us online. Ariana, are you there?
I am. Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no, it's our honor to have you on the show, right, Dawn?
Better believe it. The more the better. And Ari, I just want you to know, I have a special blessing. I was raised by very intelligent women in Torah and also in the secular sciences and social sciences. I have no problem with women talking. I listen. I'm actually a domesticated husband myself. I'm not ashamed to say it. But ladies, before you get into your interaction, before you get into it, I'd like to share something from one of the great scholars of Spanish, Jewish Spanish history, Rabbeinu Bachi Ibn Pakuda, an 11th century scholar from the Gate of Trust, from the Duties of the Heart, and then I'll let you, then I'll turn the microphone over to you.
Okay.
This is the following teaching. It's very interesting. This predates, as anyone who's involved in social services or psychology, the idea of mindfulness. Here's an interdimensional perspective of mindfulness. So the Rabbeinu Bachi teaches us the following. Human actions that constitute either service to the Creator or engaging in things which are opposite to service to the Creator can take place if only three factors are present. Number one, a person, he or she, has to make the choice in what level they're going to engage their heart and mind. Number two, what is the intent and resolve to do what is chosen? And three, the effort now to complete the intended act, which originated in the heart and the mind, or the mind and the heart, with one's outer limbs, and bring it into actuality. That just to rely on Creator is, at a certain level, a way of rebelling against Creator, because if we don't make choices and just rely everything on Hashem, ultimately we must rely on Hashem. But the Creator himself says, choose life, in Deuteronomy 30, verses 19. So we have a choice of carrying out the intended act, which originated in our thought and our heartful meditations, or the opposite of serving. The Creator did not leave to us to make us dependent on external means that are sometimes present, other times unavailable. So why do I say, Yafa Bhatia, and I know you're a life coach, that this is an internalized type of mindfulness? Because in mindfulness, from my experience in the field, is that we're asking people to focus outside of themselves when they're feeling some sort of anxiety or depression or some sort of manic episode, and they calm down by looking at the four walls in my apartment, I'm looking at the computer in front of me, I'm looking at my collection of books, Baruch Hashem, that are Torah. But Rabbeinu Bach is saying, look inside, and that will make you grounded in who you are, and that itself, I'm going to humbly reason out, without a source in Torah, this is the Torah version of mindfulness. Become mindful of who you are in your thought and heartful meditations. Use your limbs and carry it out into action. And one of the beautiful things that are taking place now is that many people are meditating with their heart and their mind and talking about it, and now bringing into action the manifestation of the B'nai Anusim movement. I'm handing the ball to you, Yafia. Bhatia.
Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. We talk a lot about serving Hashem in thought, in word, speech, and in deed. And in deed means action. It could be action of our hands. It could be action of our feet. Walking to do a mitzvah, walking someplace to go visit somebody who's ill. Walking to shul or to the congregation. There's all kinds of things we mean when we say indeed. And those are the three areas of our life that we need to understand. There has to be an element of our relationship to our Hashem, our closeness to Hashem, in all three of those areas. Now, in terms of thought, okay, we have a wonderful, wonderful way of being close to Hashem in something called personal prayer. The Hebrew is Hit Bodedut. And there's an incredibly beautiful, wonderful book that explains all of this. It's called In Forest Fields by Rabbi, his name just went out from me. I'll get it for you in a minute. Avshalom, I think. And it's a wonderful, wonderful explanation of how we can become closer and closer every day, inch by inch, not mile by mile, in our thought life by having personal prayer or personal conversation with Hashem. It's not the ritual prayers. It's not out of the prayer book, although we could also expand on the prayer book with our own personal thoughts about certain portions of it. But it's a wonderful way to connect to Hashem. And then in speech, when we praise Hashem, and not just in prayer, verbally, orally, but when we, like somebody says, how are you doing, today, or how you feel, and we say, Baruch Hashem, I'm doing great. So in speech, we can serve Hashem and remind people of Hashem and what he's doing in the world and how wonderful things are in our life. And then, of course, indeed. So It's all three in terms of serving Hashem. And all of that comes from a wellspring inside of us. Because as you know, Dawn, as a coach, and you also know this, all true and lasting change comes from within. It has to come from within. It can't come from outside. Can't be compelled. Can't be forced. Any of that. It has to come from within. And ultimately, the source of all of that inside of us is our neshama, is our soul. And we feed our soul every single day with our thoughts, our speech, and our deeds that are the mitzvahs that we do. And it all works together. It all plays together so beautifully, so harmoniously, like making, you know, a dish that has all different kinds of raw, fresh, natural ingredients and various forms of spices and various forms of oils that are good for you, healthy olive oil, coconut oil, stuff like that. I love to cook, so don't mind me. You know,
I love
and the dish
eat.
Comes out beautifully healthy and tasty with all of those elements in it. And that's what we try to explain to people, you know, that we're working with, who are coming back from the banana scene, from having been secretly Jewish, called crypto Jews, secret Jews, whatever, or banana scene, because our ancestors had to hide. And they had to hide because of the hatred of the Jewish people in the church, okay, and they were so fearful to come out publicly and be known to be Jewish. So our ancestors had to do those things, but now with this banana scene movement of people coming back now publicly, openly, to being Jewish and having helped to do that with the rabbis and with being taught Torah, you know, so we can observe the mitzvahs in public now instead of just privately in the home, secretly in the home, the customs and traditions. Actually, I want to talk to Ariana about that, what were the kinds of customs and traditions in her family, you know, that she found out about or knew about growing up or whatever. But anyway, the group Ezra Lenassim, my organization here in Israel and Jerusalem, is growing phenomenally, Baruch Hashem. We keep adding more and more people to the organization in terms of managing directors. I was just talking to a fellow before the call into your blog talk radio, Dawn, who's going to be adding 40 emerging communities of B'nai Anasim to our organization that he's been working with over the years. I knew him many years ago in Miami, and we sort of lost touch with each other, and he's continued to do what he's been doing, and now he wants himself and all these 40 emerging communities to join with us. It's just incredible what's going on. But, all right, but to Ariana. Now, Ariana has joined our organization of managing directors, taking various pieces of the work that's going on, and she's going to be in charge of social media for Ezra Lenassim. But she has her own story. And so today I'd like Ariana to introduce herself, talk a little bit about her background and who she is and what she does, and a little bit about her story, you know, of coming back, and then we'll see if we have any questions for her. So Ariana, can you do that for us?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, beginning with who I am, I was born and raised in Los Angeles, and I'm currently a college student full-time, but I have been working on the side with various nonprofit organizations within the Jewish community, as really honestly being one of them now. And I have worked previously a lot in social media marketing and advertising for other nonprofits. So it's an honor to be doing this for Ezra Lenassim team now.
Oh, it's an honor to have you, really. So what happened with your history, with your family, with your background?
Yes. So that's one of my favorite questions. I have a very interesting background. Both of my parents were born in Iran, and ethnically, my mother's mother is Sephardic from Granada, Spain. After the Inquisition, they fled to the Ottoman Empire, to Izmir, Turkey, where our family members took large roles in the Jewish community there. my maternal great-great-grandmother, her like uncle or great-uncle was the chief rabbi of Izmir. They had a lot of powerful figures in the Jewish community there. And
wow.
During times of hardship, there were wars with Russia and there were financial issues. My family fled around the late 1700s and fled from Izmir, Turkey to Hamadan, Iran. And
wow.
upon entering Iran, they were Jewish and immigrants, and obviously that was not going to fly in a heavily Muslim empire. So they
uh-huh.
were forced to either go somewhere else or enter the country under a different religious title. And
okay.
this was around the early 1800s now, and there was a new faith emerging in that region of Iran called the Baha'i faith. And it's not Islam, but they acknowledge a lot of the religious figures, Moshe Rabbeinu having been one of them. And so that religion provided a lot of safety for Jews that were being persecuted, such as my family entering as immigrants. They took that
mm-hmm.
upon themselves to identify outwardly as Baha'i, which was a huge underrated phenomenon happening in Iran at this time in the Jewish community. And they were able,
okay.
because of this, to enter safely. And that's how my mother's side of the crypto-Judaism began, because they didn't identify as Muslim when they entered the country. So they had the ability to keep a lot of their traditions that went down into our heritage and our experience now growing up in like modern day society. My grandmother, my mother kept a lot of traditions that, interestingly enough, my grandfather, who was also Jewish, fleeing from the Russian pogroms during the revolution, came to Iran with the same intentions as well. And they made it really a big part of our family to keep these traditions alive without identifying them as Jewish traditions.
Wow, wow, wow. That's amazing. That's really amazing.
Yeah.
Can I just chime in for a second?
Oh, sure. Of course.
I mean, first of all, I want to congratulate you for linking and working now with Israel Amuta.
Thank you.
Yafa Bhatia, because I think it's about 2+ years Yafa Bhatia and I have been collaborating on these humble efforts here on Blog Talk Radio, Soul Class. So you're working with solid, fertile, joyous soul of experience, and I mean S-O-U-L and S-O-I-L. Also, you mentioned that your family moved to Hamadan. I have friends who are from Iran who got out at the time of the revolution. And one of my friends told me, and please, if you can back this up, or maybe you have a different view, Hamadan was actually named after Haman. People don't realize there's a living history to this day. People have traditions. They know where Esther and Mordechai are buried over there, and I don't know if they know where Haman is buried. But correct me, maybe I'm misunderstood. Is Hamadan a city that was named after Haman from the Purim story?
You know, I haven't heard that myself, but
right.
I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case. I mean, it's an inside joke in the Persian Jewish community that everyone from Hamadan is a grandchild of Queen Esther. So I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case.
Wow.
Okay.
That's amazing. Yeah, we know the graves are there. The kever of Mordechai
mm-hmm.
and Esther, Queen Esther, are there still in Iran.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's a huge, huge holy site for the remaining Jews there. And even the Muslim and secular people find it really fascinating that such a powerful part of our Jewish narrative exists right there in the middle of Iran. And
yes.
It's really incredible to think about how once upon a time, about 20% of the Persian Empire was Jewish. And
yeah, right.
It's really incredible to see how a lot of those Jews have become B'nai HaNassim, and
uh-huh.
it's a really, really underrated phenomenon. A lot of them have become Muslim. A lot of them have become Baha'i and Christian just because it was so difficult to be a Jew. And
wow.
So many people don't know. And part of my incredible, really, really, Baruch Hashem, incredible experience working with Yafa is that from the day we decided we were going to do this together, people have been messaging me of Persian heritage, say, or of Moroccan heritage, really deeply integrated in Islamic societies where they're from, in countries where they're from, saying, you know, I was raised a devout Muslim or Christian or Baha'i all my life, and I go to visit my grandmother's grave, and there's a Magen David on it, and I had no idea.
Right.
Like,
well,
little
right.
things like that that are really just blazing the way for the unseen community, and just so many people are waking up and discovering their heritage and trying to find ways to come back, which is why it's so amazing to be working with Azrael Anastim, because it's so rewarding, and there are so many people who need this kind of help.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And, you know, the migratory path, we knew for the crypto-Jews, is the ones who had to be secretly Jewish because of the Inquisition. We know very, very well the migratory path west towards
yes.
the New World. I mean, they went to the island colonies of Spain and Portugal, like Mallorca and the Azores, where my mother's family came from, and also Canary Islands and Cape Verde and all of those. And then, of course, the New World, Mexico and Spain and the Caribbean islands and ultimately United States. And then went further west into, Australia and New Zealand and Philippines and Indonesia.
Yeah.
So that's very, very well understood. What's not so well understood is that when the Spanish Jews left Spain, instead of a sea route for their migration, many of them went over the border into Portugal and got caught there and were forcibly converted. But there were another, we don't know how many exactly, went over the border over the Pyrenees Mountains, which is a natural border between Spain and France, and they went into southern France. Then they had to become secretly Jewish there. Then, by boat, they went to Italy and Sicily and Sardinia. And we have people working with those folks, the B'nai Hashem in that arena, okay, because, of course, the church was powerful there in Italy, in Rome. And then they also, like you say, went to the Ottoman Empire, which is what it was at the time, today modern Turkey. But a lot of people, which you represent, and the people from ancient Persia or Iran today, what a lot of people don't know and don't understand is that that was another secondary migration from the Ottoman Empire into what is modern-day Iran and had to be secretly Jewish there. So it's called the Middle Eastern part of the B'nai Hashem, and they had to be secretly Jewish and become Baha'i, as you say, as a cover, okay, so they wouldn't be persecuted as Jews. It's phenomenal. It's really phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a lot of people talk about this because most people think that Persian Jews have been there since the Babylonian times, which is true, but
mm-hmm.
a lot of our history indicates that many people actually came directly from Spain after the Inquisition to a small part of Iran called Kashan. And we have a very large line of rabbis of the Shofet family that are very prevalent here in Los Angeles. And they have lots of evidence of their heritage being directly from Spain.
Wow.
Arian, can you repeat that? You said the Shofet family from the rabbinical Shofet
yes.
family in Chabad? Very interesting. And also, the Lubavitcher Rebbe mentioned that the blood of Spain runs through his veins.
Wow. Interesting. I don't
yes.
know if they're Chabad per se, but I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of them were involved in Chabad as well. They're a very prevalent family here in the Persian community in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Okay.
Can I
wanted to ask you, going back to your journey and your personal experiences, when you know, some people in the Benassim world have customs and traditions in the family that they didn't even know were Jewish. They find out later, as you say, there's an awakening going on. But in some families, they did know those customs and traditions were Jewish, and they were told, shh, you know, don't talk about it, don't tell anybody. Which side was your family on, keeping it very, very secret so that people didn't even know those customs were Jewish customs, or did they actually pass down the Jewish identity and you knew that your great-grandmother or whatever was Jewish?
So the customs and traditions was one of my first real indications that of Jewish ancestry. We never would openly identify them as Jewish customs and traditions, even though they were like extremely obvious, such as even so my mother's father's side, who immigrated to Iran from the former Soviet Union, kind of kept it more intensely because they were very recent. This was my, you know, my maternal grandfather's, my mom's dad. So they were very recent, not as distantly connected as my grandmother's mom's family. But they had the same value system of Shabbat, which was a huge deal in my family. Every single Friday night, family dinner, candlelit family dinner. And this is what they did forever in Iran, even inviting non-Jewish people just to seem less suspicious. And I don't believe there were any really religious elements of Shabbat. I don't think my grandfather wore a kippah and there was no kiddush or anything, but they definitely kept that tradition of the candle lit exclusively Friday night family dinner, where everyone would dress up and spend time with the family, minimal connection with the outside world, no, you know, electricity, obviously, none of that. And this was passed down to my upbringing, which was very adamantly secular. Both of my parents are scientists, so they were very against any form of organized religion. But these traditions were still extremely important. Up until the passing of my grandfather, we were keeping Shabbat every single week, but no one knew it was Shabbat. My grandmother had very strange ways of cooking. Growing up, we all had two refrigerators, one packed with dairy and one packed with meat products and vegetables, which I never thought was strange until I started going to other people's homes and seeing that most people only have one refrigerator. And we had two ovens, two sinks, multiple sets of dishes and silverware. And my grandmother was extremely particular about how everything worked, the way that she would always strangely cook or wash meat in salt water before cooking it and boiling pots and pans after using them. One of the big ones was throwing away eggs with blood spots. The way that she would wash vegetables just for like hours before making a salad, would be scrubbing vegetables and lettuce and kale to make sure there were no dirt or bugs caught inside of it. With fruit, she would do the same thing. And these were things that I thought were absolutely bizarre. But when I would be in the kitchen with her, she would make sure I was following in her footsteps of doing all of these things. Otherwise, she wouldn't present the food for our family to be eaten. So these were things that were that stood out a lot in terms of the culinary traditions.
And I'm curious about eggs, raw eggs. Did she check for blood in the eggs?
Yes, and she would, I mentioned that, and she would throw them out if there were blood spots in the eggs.
Okay. And what about the veins? I'm curious about this because this was in my family, and I know it's not rabbinic because in the rabbinic world, there's a little bit of a blood clot at the base of the thigh of the chicken that is considered okay. It's kosher to eat it. And there's a vein in the chicken leg. that you can't really take out when it's raw, but after it's cooked, it's very easy to see it, okay? And in my family, we were raised that you take your thumb for that blood clot and you pop it out with your thumb. It's blood. You don't eat blood, right? And after the chicken is cooked, when you're eating the thigh, and I love the chicken leg and the thigh portion of the chicken leg, you take that vein out and you don't eat it. It's disgusting to me. It turns my stomach because the way we were raised. And, right. Of course, it's okay. It's actually kosher, according to the rabbis. But in our tradition, we didn't eat it, and we threw it out because it's blood. There's this prohibition against blood. Did any of that, did you see any of that with your grandmother?
It's funny you mentioned that because, again, I never would have known that that was part of kashrut, but I have recollection of my grandmother doing that and going through chicken and throwing away, like, a vein or anything that had that looked like there was blood on it or recooking it.
Yep.
Yeah, I've seen that before, which is so weird. I never would have been able to identify that as an unassumed tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a huge prohibition for the B'nai Anushim was, again, it's straight out of the Torah, is not to eat blood, you know. But
right.
When a chicken is kosher and when it's killed and it's slaughtered correctly, according to the rules, and the blood is drained, that blood that congeals and forms in those areas, you know, is fine, it's perfectly kosher. And I think you said she used to soak the meat, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
my mother did too.
Yeah. In Iran, one of the reasons why they remained secret Jews was because they were immigrants and were very poor. It was difficult to find work as a Jew or as an immigrant entering the Persian Empire. And there was this concept called jizya taxes, where they would pay taxes to Jews, Jews would pay taxes to the government because they weren't Muslim. Kind of like having that part of having like that dhimmi status of being people of the book, according to the Quran, but not Muslims. So they would often have to pay very, very hefty taxes. And this would prevent a lot of Jewish people from being able to purchase actually kosher meat. And
right.
I remember I would see my grandmother. I don't remember if all of the meat that she would buy growing up had a hechsher on it on the packaging or was specifically from a kosher market. It usually was like 99% of the time. But she would go and soak every single thing that we would put in a pan in salt water, whether it was chicken or beef or fish, and she would wash it with salt water in this very strange way. And that was one of the things that I was first able to identify as part of this like very ancient tradition of how they would keep kosher.
Right. It's really phenomenal. It's really incredible what's been going on, what they had to do in order to survive, you know, given whatever circumstances they were in whatever country they were in. So what happened? How did you make your transition or whatever you call it to where you are now?
Right. Well, my first experiences with Judaism were definitely around the time period that all of my friends and my peers were having their bar and bat mitzvahs, and I was deeply integrated into a very Jewish community at birth. My grandparents made sure that my mother and all of her siblings were walking distance from a shul, which meant that our communities were always very Jewish. And all of our doctors and our lawyers and our neighbors and the people that we worked with were always Jewish. And this was kind of like a mandate that my grandparents had. And so we never identified as being a part of that community, but we were always surrounded by them. So I remember the first bat mitzvah I ever went to and I heard Torah for the first time. hysterically burst into tears. And I went up to the rabbi after the service and told him, "Hey, I'm Jewish, but I'm lost. Can you help me?"
Wow.
And he said, "Sure, you can come back when you're 18 and we can help you go through a conversion process if that's what you need." And I was like, okay. Obviously, I never ended up going back because Hashem decided to take the reins from there and just put me on this incredible path. Where about a couple years after that, I think I was looking for my passport in our safe, and I stumbled across some paperwork in a very strange language that I couldn't understand, and it was Hebrew, and they were Hebrew school papers, my grandparents' Hebrew school papers, and this was the first document of evidence that I ended up acquiring when I was about 15 years old. And I went and asked my grandmother and my mom about it, and I said, "What's this language? What does this mean?" My grandma snatched it from me and said, "They're Jewish school papers. They don't mean anything." And she took them, and I never saw them again. And I was like, oh, okay, just Jewish school papers. Not a big deal. I went on. And the more I studied and saw what it was like in the Jewish communities and that all Jews go to Hebrew school that are were a part of the observant communities that I knew of. And I realized that somebody who was Baha'i or Muslim in Iran would not go to Hebrew school. Uh-huh. And I began researching, and back then, because it was so dangerous to be a Jew, they would not admit you into a Hebrew school if you did not have evidence of being halachically Jewish. And
okay.
This is what stood out to me the most. And so I was like, this is insane, and I'm going to DNA test everyone in my family because they're not open enough. So I DNA tested my mom, myself, and my grandmother. How I got her to agree with doing that, I don't remember. But obviously, they came out with having a very significant portion of Jewish ethnicity, but that's not what I was interested in. I already had a hunch about that. I wanted to see the people that we were related to. And obviously an overwhelming majority of them were Jewish, and then the rest of them were Spaniards. Yeah, so they are also, I guess, bananasim who either know they're Jewish or they don't, and they're just living in Spain. But a lot of them were Israelis, Persian Jews even, and then Turkish and other Sephardic Jews living around the world. And I got in contact with them, and that's when things started unlocking. Because when I shared what I knew about my family, that's when people were like, it was clicking for them, and they were just sending me documents and documents and documents and documents. And I eased my grandmother into opening up about her past a little bit. And my grandmother's mother belongs to a huge Hakim family, and they were a huge Sephardic family back then. Again, my grandmother's like great uncle or something like that was the chief rabbi of Izmir in Turkey. And then when they came to Iran, they still maintained a big reputation of being from, you know, a big Jewish family. And so even though they weren't outwardly identifying that way, in the community of other crypto Jews, it was known. And so when my grandmother started incrementally revealing names, I was able to kind of put them together with the documents that my relatives from the DNA testing were sending to us. And we were getting ketubah records and family trees and documents of things from parts of books that people have written about our family. And that's when I realized that there's way too much Jewish evidence to be ignored. And that's when I started desperately contacting people and rabbinical authorities to help me interpret what this meant. And when I came across you, Yaffa, on somebody's website that said, contact this person if you think you have Jewish heritage. And that's when I contacted you and sent you like a desperate email trying to get more information.
Right.
You sent me a list of rabbis to get in contact with, and they have been beyond helpful in my situation and completely saw that I have so much evidence of unbroken matrilineal Jewish descent. And one of the biggest pieces of evidence that I received was my grandmother's family tree that she didn't even know she had. And it was all in Hebrew, so I didn't even know that's what it was at the time.
Oh, wow.
And it was a family tree dating back to like the 1700s with every person on it except my grandmother, because they stopped it after she was born. But my grandmother's mom, my grandma's grandma, her mom, her grandmother, everyone was in there, and it was all in Hebrew, and this was just undeniable proof.
Oh, wow. Amazing. Really amazing. And, of course, a lot of our people don't have proof at all. They'll have evidence, you know, like the customs and traditions. And
right.
Maybe some immigration records showing the migratory path and from where the ancestors originated, stuff like that. Maybe they can do a family tree back, you know, 50 years, 100 years, a couple of hundred years, but not the, I mean, you have more than evidence. You actually have proof.
Right.
Yeah, that's very rare.
Can I just chime in? Would you be interested in giving kudos to those rabbis who assisted you along your pathway?
Oh, yeah. My beloved rabbi, who has been there for me since the beginning, Rabbi Yonatan Halevi, who works with us, has been so helpful in helping me understand what all of these documents were and writing my letter and everything. I could not be doing what I'm doing and continuing to strengthen and develop my relationship with Hashem and the rest of my community that I was separated from if it weren't for he and his wife. So I really have to thank them, because I would not be able to be where I am now if it were not for them and their help and support.
Now, Don, this is a rabbi in San Diego who was trained to be a rabbi by the Sephardic Center, Shehabar Sephardic Center in the Old City of Jerusalem, which I'm also connected to, the head of that yeshiva, Rabbi Sam Kassin. And it's just a wonderful organization. They train Sephardi rabbis for all over the world, and Rabbi Halevi is one of their rabbis. And he's a fabulous, fabulous person, he and his wife. They're just wonderful people.
You said Halevi?
Ken, Halevi, right.
Halevi, well, that's the role of the Levim, the Levites, to be madrich, to educate our people. I mean, that's going back to Moshe. So they're still there. They haven't retired from their service, Baruch Hashem.
No, not at all, not at all. So, Ariana, so how has your family reacted, responded? How do they feel about what you've been doing and reconnecting to your Jewish roots and all of that?
My mother has been very supportive and excited to be going through this. She has really warmed up to it. And it's funny, Don, that you mentioned that little fact about the Levites. A lot of our documentation on both my mother and my mother's mother and her father's side say that they're both descended from the Levite tribe. So that's interesting.
Beautiful.
And that's something that actually really stood out to my mom, and she started researching and getting into it. And for the first time 2 years ago, my mom started coming with me to shul.
Beautiful.
Oh, wow.
Shabbat. And for the holidays, she and my sister now come every year for Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. And it's been amazing to have them do this with me out of their own desire. And they, obviously, Shabbat has been a huge tradition in my family, so we still continue doing that. And my mother helps me light the candles, and I taught all of my aunts the bracha, and it's amazing to have them be interested in doing this. But the biggest form of resistance I experienced was from my grandmother. Being Jewish caused so much trauma for her. Her mother and her grandmother were actually ended up being killed for being Jewish.
Wait.
Yeah.
Where was this that they were killed?
So this was still in Iran. This now they had moved to Tehran, Iran. And because they were so poor, my great-great-grandmother married a non-Jewish man who was from a very big, wealthy family in the Muslim community. And he found out later on, in, much later on in life, that he and his wife, I'm sorry, his wife and his daughter were ethnically Jewish, and this was a huge scandal in his family, and they threatened to revoke his inheritance if he did not do something about it, let's say.
Whoa.
And so, you know, his wife and his daughter were just like that. He took care of them, unfortunately. And my grandmother's father took my grandmother and her siblings and fled to Kurdistan, Iraq, and raised them there to protect them from the family from searching for them. So that was really traumatic. My grandmother lost her mother and her grandmother when she was about 6 years old. And so me returning to Judaism in the beginning was like, my grandmother was furious. Like, how could you return to something that caused so much pain and trauma for our family? Why?
Right.
What could compel
you
to do that?
Uh-huh.
And I stuck to my emunah, and I knew that Hashem was taking me on the right path, as he always does. And I was really understanding of my grandmother's position, but I knew that I can't live a life ignoring who I am. And I owe it to my grandparents and my great-grandparents who suffered from so much persecution to give back to the community and dedicate my life to making sure that those who perished did not die in vain, and that their heritage and their lineage will be represented with pride. I could not let myself lead a different life. And I knew that eventually, whether or not my grandmother would be understanding of this, that this is what Hashem wanted from me. And otherwise, I would not have gone through this experience that is so unbelievable. And my grandmother, with time, really, Baruch Hashem, with time, started to see that nothing bad was happening for me returning to observance. And little by little, she started warming up to it and started telling the stories and admitting it. So incredible to see her start to slowly take part.
Yeah, and you were very wise to allow her that time for adjustment, given the traumatic circumstances, you know, of her family. And as a coach, of course, and I've dealt with trauma. People have experienced other forms of trauma, but trauma is trauma. And
yes,
we just have to, you know, give them time and space, because, again, the changes that go on and that can happen and will happen if Hashem, you know, blesses it, has to come from within, has to come from them. It can't come from outside, even though we might want to try to help them until they're ready for that help and they want it. It's really, we just have to give them space and time.
Yeah,
can
absolutely.
May I chime in? That,
yeah, John, go
that
ahead.
For those who are traumatized, I mean, it cross-pollinates over to the idea of addiction, because I'm involved in tobacco cessation trainings for staff where I work in the social service agency I'm a part of, that therefore there's a simple paradigm which really relates to all forms of scenarios in human living experience: pre-contemplation, contemplation, action, and maintenance. And many times people are just unaware of the ability to go beyond that experience, which has hurt them so much, because that's all they know. And then they have to be brought to a either from within themselves, or others can facilitate the contemplation stage, where then they have to, and for some people this is very murky waters, the ambivalent stage, where they have to evaluate the pros and cons of going forward to try to get out of their ambivalence. As one person once said to me, I'd rather stick with the demons that I know than you know, take the chance of encountering new ones who might be even worse than the ones I'm already dealing with.
Right, right. Yeah, that's true. That's true. So, Ariana, to kind of wrap it all up, what would you like to
say about the future and what you'd like to do, you know, for the Jewish community, for the Persian community, anything like that that you're hopeful about, you know, being helpful to other people, whatever.
Well, in terms of working with you now, it's such an honor to be able to provide an outlet to others that have the same background. And there is an overwhelming amount of people that do share this background. One of my relatives actually wrote a book about this, Professor Mehrzad Amanat, who is a history professor at UCLA. And he wrote a book about this entire situation. I think it's called Resistance to Conversion, or Resistance to Islam, Jewish Identities in Iran. And there is so much information about these circumstances coming out. And there are so many people who are discovering evidence of having B'nai Anusim heritage, a lot of them specifically from Spain and Portugal, so directly affected by the Inquisition that went to the Middle East. Like I mentioned previously, I was in touch with a couple people who are Persian and discovered that they have heritage, people from Morocco, a lot of people from Syria who thought that they were Muslim but ended up discovering their Jewish heritage. And just to be in any way involved with this movement is what makes my life worth living. And I owe this to my grandparents and my great-grandparents to thank them for giving me an opportunity to be alive by sacrificing their Jewish identity. And we have to pay it forward and give it back. And if there is anything that can be done to aid the B'nai Anusim communities, it must be done, because they're— We had this conversation a little while ago, Yaffa. There are so many parts of the Torah and so many religious texts that frequently mention that there is no future of Am Yisrael if we don't return, or help those return who have been exiled. There is no future for us as the Jewish people without helping our lost brothers and sisters come back from persecution and apostasy. And there are so many descendants of B'nai Anusim. They're like, we're in like the 100 millions, right, of people spread around the world.
Yeah, people with this ancestry, it's anywhere from 100 to 500 million, according to the demographic experts. And I agree with you. We, of course, you know, we need to help the B'nai Anusim for the people living today. But it's also for our ancestors, because I think of my grandmother and great-grandmother. I knew my great-grandmother better than my grandmother, who died. She died when I was about 6, but my great-grandmother didn't pass away until I was a teenager, and I knew her a lot better. So it's also for our ancestors who I'm sure prayed very, very hard that their descendants someday would be allowed to make this return. That's happening right now as we speak with the B'nai Anusim movement. And so it's for people living today, and it's for all of our ancestors who asked Hashem that someday this would happen, that their descendants would be allowed to return, if not them, and ultimately come back to the land as well, our land that Hashem gave to all of the Jewish people here in Israel, of course. So it's all of that. And Don, I'll throw it back to you. Thank you so much for this program that you're doing, your piece of our work in helping the B'nai Anusim. I know we have 44 people listening from about 44 countries, I think, last time you told me about that. And I just appreciate you so much for having us do this show once a month. It's really a huge, huge mitzvah, and I really appreciate it. And thank you, Ariana, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me,
Yaffa.
Don, thank you.
No problem. And Ariane, since you're the managing director for social media for Ezra Anusim Israeli Amuta, you know, my name is Don Zusya, Z-U-S-Y-A Goodman. If there's anything in your collaboration with the organization that you want to put on my wall in Facebook, go right ahead. I mean, Yafabati knows she has free reign to post whatever she wants on my Facebook page. And if I can be a billboard as well as a talking board and a springboard for further collaborations. And I just want to mention as well that I've mentioned on more than one occasion with Yafabati live on the air that from my wife's family, from her father's side, that at the time of the Inquisition, that my wife says the Holton. I mean, I don't know the exact data, but she said most of, if not all of the Jews from Toledo, Spain, then moved into Eretz Israel. So, and interacting with members of my wife's family from this fine stack of jewelry, I know there's a lot more that has to be introduced back into the fold, whether it be reversion or conversion or whatever scenario that's according to, you know, Torah Israel. So that's that, just to explain to you why I'm involved. And Yafabati won me over with her knowledge as well as her simple faith in the Almighty that this is a cause worth verbally fighting for and advocating for. And you know, in this last year, she has seen exponential growth in different fashion. And I think you're part of the exponential growth. And I congratulate you on your wise move to partner up with Yafabati da Costa.
Thank you so much, Don. We've got so many people doing it today, Don. Hashem is just blessing this movement and the people in it in an incredible way, in many ways, and you're one of them. You're one of the blessings and gifts that Hashem has given us. So
and let's go back
that.
To that ancient, Yafabati, can we end on this, that ancient prophecy from the Navi Avadia? What's that about? Remind everyone.
Right. In verse 20, it talks about, by the way, the people from France. It says in Hebrew, Zarephath. And then the second part of verse 20 of Ovadia says, and the exiles from Yerushalayim at Sepharad will inherit the cities of the south of the Negev. And Sepharad, of course, is the Iberian Peninsula of Spain and Portugal.
Beautiful. With that being said, let's start again. We're thanking. We're thanking Yafabati Costa, CEO of Ezra Nusim Israel Muta, and now new social media managing director, Ariana Sadako, for sharing one of the most precious resources they can have in this living world, their precious time. This is Don Zussi Goodman, your Torah Askan, your local international cyberspace activist, wishing everyone a wonderful week. And may all of our efforts proceed in the way of Ahavachad, one love, Goralachad, one destiny, Kolano, Bedarchan, Umdarki, Sholem, in a pleasant and peaceful way. And I'll remind everyone, but I'll remind myself before anyone else, we've all got to be good. I've got to be good. Because a tevatov lehaiti, which is nature to good to do good, and the Creator is the source of our goodness, waits ever so patiently for us to actualize all our potentialities as faithful human stewards for this blessed earth. This is, and I assert with all of the powers of my soul, this is Anti-Eugenics Radio. Everyone has been blessed with a divine image to get out in scrimmage, never to be disappointed, and to realize they are anointed with the Tzelem Elokim, which is no dream. Take care, everyone.